Welcome, friends. I hope you're well today. I'm Henrik. Thank you for tuning in to Red Eyes Radio. This is the one and only independent radio program that goes far and wide in a search for answers. And we do not shy away from looking under the rug and in the darkest of corners and shadows in order to gain better understanding of world events, history, conspiracies, and the more occult and esoteric aspects as well. We have independent investigator, writer, and former journalist Ole Damegård with us, who has been working hard on tracking the network of assassinators connected with Operation 40 that have been involved in some of the most high-profile assassinations in the world, from JFK to RFK and Olof Palme, and a slew of other ones, both unknown and known. He is the author of the book Coup d'etat in Slow Motion, where he turns out the facts behind the assassination of Swedish Prime Minister Olof Palme. This is what led him to JFK, and he has pieced together the puzzle, as he sees it, around the assassination of John F. Kennedy, and this is what we are going to discuss during the coming 2.5 hours or so. So stay tuned for who was involved and how it was pulled off. Hello, Herr Damegård. Welcome back. I hope you've been well since we last spoke and did our series earlier last year. It's good to have you back again, Ole.
Thank you so much, Henrik. It's a true honor.
Excellent. So you've been keeping on diving deep into the assassination, death squad trenches, really, with the JFK murder at the center of this, not only as a good example, but it's one of the most high-profile cases that I think a lot of people around the world actually have as a clear reference point when we do talk about assassinations. And then, of course, from this point, you've been continuing to branching out much into the same crowd and people that we did our series on last year on the Swedish Prime Minister Olof Palme and all the other murders and assassinations that have been kept on going since then. So we're going to kind of continue in that vein here today, really, but we're going to focus a bit more on the JFK murder and really detail some of that. So just lead us into it, Ole, and we will kind of we'll branch off as we see fit here, and then we'll just get to all the things. I know we have a lot of exciting news and developments you want to mention to us today as well.
Okay, thank you, Henrik. I'll be happy to do that. I just want to start up to say that the reason why this assassination of JFK is so important is that it's so much more than just a murder in the early 1960s. It was a coup d'etat where a power elite made a violent overtake of the United States. And according to my research and many, many other researchers as well, this power elite have stayed in power to this very day, so that the people that were part of killing JFK to get rid of him so that they could take over are still the one running the show and are the ones that are pushing this world into this very, very dark and controlled place that they're trying to transform the world into. So I feel it's very, very important to expose this in great detail. So to be able to in that direction, also expose what is going on today so that we can stop this development into this dark, very scary place and instead turn this world into this beautiful, beautiful place that it's meant to be. So this is why I've spent it's almost 30 years now on trying to, in very great detail, understand what actually happened. And like I say, for me, it started in the early 1980s. The first time I saw the Zapruder film. The Zapruder film, for those listeners who don't know about that, that was an amateur film that was filmed by an amateur and that showed the whole assassination, the few seconds when the American president was killed, in great detail. And through this film, it is very obvious that the final shot, the headshot, came from the front and to the right, pointing toward what is known as the grassy knoll, and not which we're told by the official story, that it came from behind and upwards from the sixth floor and the Texas School Book Depository, where the so-called patsy, Lee Harvey Oswald, is supposed to have been shooting from.
Right.
So when I saw that, I really understood that, my God, this thing that we're being fed through media, there's something very, very wrong with that. And that after that, I think I read a couple of hundred books on the JFK assassination. And then from there, I got more and more interested in the Robert Kennedy assassination, the Martin Luther assassination, and so on, Malcolm X, all the way back to Abraham Lincoln, and also back to the Roman times. And I started after a while to see a very clear picture of how these assassinations were carried out, almost like by a template. And then while I was getting more and more into this, the Swedish Prime Minister, Olof Palme, was shot dead in, it's almost, I think it's 28 years now,
yeah,
within a few days on the 28th of February. And to start with, I thought that we had a beautiful, great police in Sweden, that it was a democracy where you could trust the government, where you could trust the police and so on. But it didn't take that long before there was a lot of strange things going around this investigation as well. And after a while, I started seeing that the exact same template was being used in Sweden as had been used in the States or in Chile or in South Africa and so on. They were using the same template, how to commit or carry out an assassination on a very, very high level, and how to dupe the population into thinking that it was the work of a lone crazy guy. So once I started seeing that it was actually being used in Sweden as well, and I was able to even predict what the Swedish government investigation was going to do, first I got really freaked out because I thought, oh my God, this turned my whole world upside down. But then after that, I started looking upon these assassinations from a much higher perspective, trying to see how on earth can they be so similar if they're not connected. And now, 30 years down the road, I've been able to find very clear trails and evidence that these assassinations, many of these major assassinations and so-called terror acts, are being ordered by the same power elite, the same global power elite, and has been carried out by more or less the same hit team. And so this is what I would like to focus on this evening, to expose in great details this hit team, who they were, and also what actually happened in Dealey Plaza this Friday afternoon in 1963, when the American president was brutally slaughtered.
Yeah, very good. So where would you like to begin, Ola?
I would like to begin with maybe to just give a little background, because there's so many theories going on about, did Jackie Kennedy shoot him, or did the driver shoot him, or did whoever shoot him? Was it the mob? Was it the KGB and so on? The way to look at it, if I can suggest a good way of seeing it, is like, who has the power to get away with a thing like this? Who has got the power to cover it up? Who has the power to control the media in such a way that even 50 years down the road, it's still a big mystery? You have to look upon it like that, and then go backwards in and see what actually happened that day. And also, once again, who had the power to carry these things out? And you will see that we're not talking about a lone crazy guy, or a crazy driver in the limo, or Jackie Onassis, or whatever. I mean, that after a while, it just becomes like a big joke, because you will soon start to see that it's a massive, massive operation, multi-layered and multifaceted, on totally built up on a need-to-know basis, where the people that were involved to carrying it out, many of them didn't even know what they were doing. They were just given a task, and they were performing that, not knowing that it was actually aimed at killing the president. So it's a very, very intricate jigsaw that needs to be put together. But I do believe now that I've been able to identify more or less all the different shooters, the positions, how they got in and out of Dallas this day and so on, and the different connections. And so this is one of the ways I would like to describe this, by following the vehicles and also what the different witnesses saw. And some people have been standing up telling the truth, that were people that were involved and so on. And also there's today we have a man by the name of James Files, who has admitted that he was the one who fired the final headshot from behind the picket fence. And once again, quite a few experts have dismissed him after studying this guy for years. I think that is a major mistake to do that, because the information he has given is incredible and it fits in perfectly into the whole jigsaw.
Interesting.
So, it's such a big thing, so I'm not really sure where to start.
Sure. Well, take your time, and you know, we'll run through it, and you know, but wherever you feel is most pertinent to begin, let's begin there.
Okay. The thing was that JFK started out as I would say the last real elected president, even though there was some fraud going on, and where the Chicago mob was involved through Frank Sinatra and through his father. JFK's father, but he won a very close victory over Richard Nixon, and he got into the White House. When he got into the White House, there was this incredible feeling of optimism. He was welcomed as a rock star. The whole White House was glamour, and there was this, like I said, this incredible feeling of hope and optimism, and let's change things, let's make them good, and all of these things. So to start with, everything worked out fine, and JFK was quite easily controlled by the global elite. They didn't have to manipulate him so much. But then came the Bay of Pigs invasion, the failed big Bay of Pigs invasion, where in the early 1960s or the late 50s, where Fidel Castro had taken over Cuba. And what he did was that he came in there and he kicked out all the gambling houses, all the casinos, all the foreign interest from this island. And we're talking like multi big bucks here. We're talking about Havana being like Las Vegas and Atlantic City joined together. I mean, a massive point of income for the mob, and other also into the government, and so on. So there was a lot of pissed off people that wanted to get rid of this man with a beard. And at that time, what they did was that before JFK was elected, President Dwight Eisenhower had decided to form to create a team of highly skilled assassins that could be used on a global scale, that could be sent right, left, and center to take out foreign leaders or whoever they had problems with. This task was given to his vice president, Richard Nixon, and the group that was organized was a group called Operation 40. Now, Operation 40 was mainly consisted of exiled Cubans that had escaped from Cuba. It was former police officers from the Air Force, from the military, and so on, that came filled with hate to Fidel Castro. So they were perfect. They were violent, disciplined people that could be pointed towards killing Fidel Castro, which they also tried several times. This group was then put together with people from the CIA. There were people like Ted Shackley, also known as the Blonde Ghost. He was super central in, I cannot say how many different assassinations globally. He's a very, very central figure in also the JFK assassination. Then you had David Attlee Phillips, also very, very high in the CIA. He later became the chief of covert operation for the Western Hemisphere. I mean, big time CIA. And E. Howard Hunt, who was also high up in the CIA, and who later was one of the Watergate burglars. These people were training and controlling this group. To start with, they were between 40 and 86 people that were trained in everything from guerrilla warfare and assassination techniques, blowing up things, you know, shooting bazookas, you name it. They were trained to do it.
Let me ask you, who did any of these have like military background, or were they later educated by the CIA, or was it a private organization that did this?
No, like I said, they came from the police, from the Air Force, from the military on Cuba and so on.
Right.
But they came and they were trained in Miami. They were trained, there were different bases. There were one base in Guatemala, there was one in Miami, there was one in Louisiana and so on, where they were trained in different types of guerrilla warfare and so on. And many of the key people in the Kennedy assassination were part of training them. Like I said, James Files, the shooter behind the picket fence, he was one of the people training there. There were Lee Harvey Oswald was involved in it with the gun running. Jack Ruby was involved in it. Guy Bannister in Louisiana, and New Orleans in Louisiana was part of this whole thing. And all these exiled Cubans, the whole machine was pointed to take out Fidel Castro. That was the idea. And the guy who was put in charge of the financing the whole group, I'm not talking about him paying them, but the guy who got the funds from Texas oil tycoons and from the mob and from the military industrial complex and so on, the guy they put in charge of that was a man by the name of George Bush Senior. This George Bush was at that point, his father was Prescott Bush, which was a very, very interesting and very central person when it came to funding the Hitler war machine. He was even accused of treason and so on. But what he was doing, what he was working for the same bankster elite, trying to fund both sides and keep the Second World War going. He and Alan Dulles and other people like that was also very central in Operation Paperclip, where they exported all of these Nazis. Most people think that the Nazi war machine was over after the Second World War. It was not. What happened was a few were sentenced, and the rest of them was imported to the States and other countries, where they were part of building up the so-called OSS, which later turned into the CIA, also the Stay Behind Network in Europe, the Gladio Network, and building up NASA and the whole banking system and so on. So this whole very central Nazi mentality has just been fundamental in modern American society that has then spread all over the world. So, like I said, and the guy that George Bush was given as his right hand in this funding part was a man by the name of Felix Rodriguez. This Felix Rodriguez has followed George Bush Sr. in his whole career as his right hand when it has been come to dealing with problems. He was also very central in the Iran-Contra scandal, where he was also the guy who tracked down Che Guevara, Fidel Castro's partner. They tracked him down in Bolivia. A small little group of military people tracked him down, and then the guy that was ordered to kill him, Felix Rodriguez, gave the order, and the one who actually pulled the trigger was a man by the name of David Morales, or David Morales. He was also way up in the CIA. He was the chief of the JM Wave station in Miami, which was a massive, big operation. And this David Morales was also at the Ambassador Hotel when Robert Kennedy was assassinated, and so on. We're talking about the same people popping up everywhere. So then came the Cuban Missile Crisis, when the Soviet Union was sending ships with missiles on towards Cuba, and this was discovered by a satellite. JFK and the American government warned the Russian government, saying, if you cross this line, they gave us a certain latitude. They say, if you cross this line, we will press the button and we will start this nuclear war. And by mistake, this ship actually crossed this line. And JFK was more or less sitting with a finger on this button that could have started absolute global mayhem. But people who were there, they said that he was sitting there with tears in his eyes and just saying, I refuse to be the one that commits this against the world. And in my humble opinion, once again, it feels that that was the point where he turned around from being somebody that you could easily manipulate, that was happy to be in the White House and have a you know, glamorous life and so on, to become a very strong individual who just said, we need to wake up and do something because this whole thing is going into total madness. And from that point, suddenly he decided to crush the CIA into 1,000 pieces. He decided to withdraw from Vietnam, a war that hadn't even started really. There was only like some 16,000 advisors, American advisors there. But this war was so crucial for the drug export from the Golden Triangle to the Western world, especially to the States.
Yeah.
And also to keep the get the war going, because the whole military industrial complex was just like, go, go, go. Their agenda is death and destruction. They just crave for these wars.
Yeah.
He wanted to withdraw. He wanted to get out of the grip of the Federal Reserve, which is a super criminal institution that keeps the American people by the throat to this very day. He wanted to, there were many different reasons why they wanted to get rid of John Kennedy. Also, that Sam Giancana, one of the mob, the boss for the Chicago mob, he had helped JFK to get to power. And what happened was that once he was in there, suddenly he turns towards them. And instead of being grateful, he started hunting them down. And he put his brother, Robert Kennedy, as, what was his title? I can't remember, Attorney General. And they started like a witch hunt on the mob. And there was about 700% more convictions within just a year or two. There were like thousands of mobsters being put away. So the whole mob situation in the States was getting into a real panic. People like Meyer Lansky, Santos Traficante, Sam Giancana in Chicago, and Carlos Marcelo in Louisiana and so on, they were all freaking out saying, we need to stop this guy. It's getting totally out of control. So JFK was pissing off a lot of people. So somewhere down the line, it came to a point where there was an order given that we need to take this guy out. Who gave that order? Nothing has been written. We're back to this total compartmentalizing, you know, where everything is just taken apart so that nobody can be traced back. But in the spring of 1963, you will see signs of this operation being prepared, and also signs of when they started preparing the patsy, who in this case was this man, Lee Harvey Oswald. And what they tried, there were different places they wanted to try and hit him. There are three places: Miami, Chicago, and Dallas. These three. Chicago, they let go of because it was too close home for Sam Giancana and so on. I think they tried in Miami, but they failed. And then it came to Dallas. And Dallas, in this case, was the perfect place to commit a thing like this. Because in Dallas, you were in oil land, you know. And Vice President Lyndon Johnson, who was also very much involved in this assassination, he had all the contacts there. And they managed to get Kennedy down to Dallas through a governor called John Connally. Now, John Connally, he was in the limo when the limo was being shot at. He was a very old friend of Lyndon Johnson, the vice president. They went way back, and I think it was in 1948, there was quite a big scandal where there was some fraud going on in an election that Lyndon Johnson won. And it turned out that I think they used votes from dead people or whatever it was. Mm-hmm. There was a couple of hundred votes that came out of nowhere. And the campaign manager at that time was no one less than John Connally. So these guys goes way back. And also in Dallas, that is also where the Bush family was located in Texas as well. And the oil tycoons was from that area. Also, what JFK had done, he had fired some of the holy cows in the CIA, people that was absolute untouchables. he had fired Alan Dulles, General Charles Cabell, and some other people. And this Charles Cabell, his brother was the mayor of Dallas, meaning that they could control it from that part as well. And also involved in this assassination was the chief of the FBI, J. Edgar Hoover. The night before the assassination, there was a secret meeting at a ranch, Clint Murchison. He was an oil tycoon as well, just outside Dallas. And at that meeting were different oil tycoons, like I said, Clint Murchison. There was H.L. Hunt. There were J. Edgar Hoover flew in just for that, and Lyndon Johnson was there as well. And that was where they took the final decision that he needs to, there's a green light, we're taking him out. So now if you look at what happened, let's see what happened that day once they arrived. There were three different places in Dallas that was prepared for an attempt to kill him. There was the airport, there was the trademark where he was supposed to give a speech, but also there was the route on the way. And what was done was that there was this perfect place called the Dealey Plaza, where they could manage to get the motorcade to make a very strange turn. First a 90 degree turn and then a 120 degree turn to the left, slowing the whole motorcade down to a very, very slow rate, meaning that so much easier to get a nice hit from different sides. But it was much more than that, because also the Secret Service, all the agents were called back. Normally they were standing on the sides of the limo or on the back of the limo. They were called back, and so they were in the follow-up car. All the motorbikers, the police, the motorcyclists were normally should have been like six or eight on the sides. All of them were pulled back. Normally the limo would have a bulletproof top on. That was taken off, thanks to that the weather was okay. And they tricked JFK into saying, oh, you should really have this roof on, you know. It would be a major risk to take it on. They were sort of going for his male proud ego, saying, because he was often one of these people that are saying that I don't care. I am the president. I will go and shake hands with normal people. I don't want to have my bodyguards around me and so on. So they tricked him into accepting that the bubble roof was taking off.
Mm.
Also, normally the president limo was placed in the middle of the motor cage so that there would be cars, lots of cars in front, lots of cars behind. And normally the press car would be right in front so that they could film the whole whatever was going on. And he would have his own doctor nearby. There would also be ambulances placed along the route and so on. And about a month before, at least weeks before, the CIA, no, the Secret Service and different security, with the help of army and so on, would go in, check all the routes and check all wherever risk could be. They would check that there were no open windows, there would be snipers on the roofs, everything would be prepared. This day, nothing. And also the ambulance was called off. There was just a few minutes before the motorcade arrived to Dealey Plaza, there was a man getting a seizure in the street. So the ambulance that was placed there went to take this man to hospital. Once they arrived there, he just walked out and he was fine. But that meant that the ambulance was out of the way. And also his JFK's own private doctor was put way back in the end of the motorcade. And then instead, the limo was number two in the whole motorcade. There was only one car in front of him, where the sheriff of Dallas, the police chief Jesse Curry, and a policeman or a sheriff called Bill Dexter was the people there. And they were the ones that showed the way, so the limo just followed. Now, if you look at the newspapers the day before and so on, the official route was going... on a street from downtown Dallas, just going very straight through the whole of Dallas, and then under what is called the Triple Underpass, a bridge, and then straight from there going to the Trademark Center where he was going to hold the speech. This is crucial when it comes to the security, that the vehicle that the president is in must not go under a certain speed because of security reasons. So when they made this very, very strange change of route, that just slowed the whole thing up and just opened up for fire from all different direction, which is exactly what happened. But since the change of this the route here, I think, was through the power of the mayor of Dallas that they managed to do that. So normal people were standing along Main Street, the one that was planned and the one that was shown in the newspapers. So it's very interesting to study the people that were standing around the other street, this alternative route that was not officially exposed. Why were the people standing here? And what we're going to find out is that many, many, many of the people around standing next on the curb and on the grassy knolls and so on are very interesting to study, because many of them are connected to the assassination itself.
Right.
So, if I start with what I've been able to find out, is that there were two places where the hit team was, or two places where people were gathering. There were sort of like meeting points. There was the Cabana Motor Hotel that was owned by Doris Day in those days. There was a very late meeting the night before where Jack Ruby was one of the members. They were also, some of the oil tycoons were there, and some of the shooters were meant to take part of that meeting as well. But due to very bad weather and so on, they didn't come until in the early morning on the 22nd. The other place was the Adolphus Hotel, which is just like a few hundred meters from Dealey Plaza. And that Adolphus Hotel, I think, can very well have been like the center, the technical center from where the whole operation was controlled from. Because when you study these big conspiracies in great detail, you will find that they will always have some kind of a commando center where the whole operation is guided from. And this very day, two people had booked in to this hotel as well. One of them was Sam Giancana, the Chicago mob boss. And he had also with him one of his lieutenants, a former police officer from Chicago. His name was Richard Kane. He was a very, very skilled shooter as well. And we will later find him in one of the positions from shooting him. So this day, there were some very specific groups coming into Dallas the day before and on the morning. And one of the teams came in from Arizona. They came and gathered at a place in Arizona called the Grace Ranch. It was owned by Peter Licavoli. He was a mobster. And he had this perfect ranch with an airstrip, with a pool, with a really perfect place, not a lot of neighbors and so on. So it was a great place for operations where they didn't want people to look in, and whoever was taking part of it could have a good time before they had to go to action and so on. So the people that came to the Grace Ranch this day was a CIA man by the name of Chauncey Holt. Chauncey Holt was a CIA operative. From time to time, he was also very much involved with the mob. And at this time, he was based in LA, where he was working as a forger for the CIA and other services. And what they did was he had been given an order to make different fake IDs. He was the one who made the fake IDs for Alec Heidel, which was the alias for Lee Harvey Oswald. He also made different IDs for Lee Harvey Oswald with that name, but he was given an order to make a bunch of fake Secret Service IDs, these shields. They were actually not fake because they used the same, it was in an office building in LA where the CIA had their one storage for their operations. And then underneath, the floor underneath was where they were manufacturing the real Secret Service badges and sheriff badges and so on. So it was perfect for them. They could just get the order from downstairs, fix the name, and just they get them delivered. So they were actually real IDs, but fake, if you understand what I mean.
Right.
So he was given the task to get this bag of fake Secret Service IDs, and the task was to deliver them to Dealey Plaza. He was going to deliver them to a man by the name of Charles Harrelson, or if he was not there, then he was going to go to the parking lot behind the Texas School Book Depository, and there was supposed to be a green pickup there where he was just supposed to put these things on the back of the pickup and just leave them. He was then ordered to, if anything went wrong, at that point he was not aware of that JFK was going down, that if anything should go wrong, he should just as quick as possible go to one of the train wagons that was placed on the back of this parking lot. It was one of the wagons was with the number 22. It looked like it was locked, but it wasn't. There was just so he could open up that and then wait inside, and then this train would just pull out, and that would be a perfect getaway from the site. So that was his task. Another man that came to this Grace Ranch, well, his name was Charles Chucky Nicoletti. He was one of the hit team, or the major hitman for Sam Giancana, the Chicago mobster, a very quiet, sophisticated man, very, very brutal, and a skilled shooter as well. So he was there, Chauncey Holt was there. Then there was another man, mobster as well, Leo Morseri, he was there, and a man by the name, a pilot called Joe Canty from the CIA. Now they were supposed to take a Cessna from the Grace Ranch and fly to Dallas, but it turned out that once they started loading all the weapons they were bringing, it was just too heavy with all these bags and four people, so they had to change the plans and instead take an old Oldsmobile. This was an Oldsmobile from 1959, mm-hmm. Blue and white, as far as I'm able to find out. And so they took this car and was driving to Dallas. But due to some very, very rough weather during the night, and also the car broke down, they got delayed and they didn't make it to Dallas until dawn. Otherwise, they were planned to go to the Cabana Motor Hotel. And I believe they were supposed to be part of this meeting, or at least meet up with some of the people there. So that's one car coming in. We have another car coming from Miami. There are two cars. In these cars that was also loaded with weapons were other members of Operation 40. There were people, as far as I know, there were a man, CIA, and also Operation 40. His name was Frank Sturgis.
Right.
He was later involved in the Watergate burglary and also in many, many operations. There was a woman called Marita Lorenz. She was the former mistress of Fidel Castro. And because of that, the Operation 40, through Frank Sturgis, they managed to get her on their team to try and take him out. But that failed. And anyway, so she was part of this operation. She didn't know either what was going on. As far as I know, there was another man closely related to Operation 40 as well, a mercenary called Jerry Patrick Hemming, and two brothers, exiled Cubans, part of Operation 40, called Ignacio Novo Sampol y Guillermo Novo Sampol. these two cars was driving towards from Miami towards Dallas some days earlier. And it was from one of these cars that a woman by the name of Rose Charamine, who used to work for Jack Ruby as in his nightclub, she was beaten up and thrown out as being dead, or thrown out at least from one of these cars and left next to the road. This is the woman, when you see the JFK movie, in the beginning, there's this woman lying in the hospital just saying, "My God, they're going to kill JFK. You need to stop them. They're going to Dallas to shoot him," and so on. This is the woman. And this woman was later killed in a hit and run accident after she had started talking too
Right,
much.
right.
There's so many of these people, witnesses or people involved, and so on, that has met a very, very violent death.
Yeah.
Okay, so also there was a plane coming, a DC-3 from Miami this morning as well. It was flown by a CIA operative, or he was the co-pilot. His name was Tosh Plumlee. He used to be part of Operation 40, but this morning he thought, at least that is what he says, and I believe him, he thought that they were flying in an abort operation, an operation to abort this assassination attempt. On this plane, there were two or three Cubans. There was a man called Sergio, and also there was somebody they called the Colonel. This Colonel, his real name was Johnny Rosselli. And Johnny Rosselli used to be a hitman for Al Capone. He later then got higher up in the ranks and became the liaison between the Chicago mob, the government, and the CIA. He was sort of the guy in between. He had loads of connections.
Exactly. Wasn't he kind of the interface also between some of the Jewish mob in Hollywood and the Sicilian mob out of Italy? He was like the guy in between. Maybe I'm mixing him up with another one, but some of these people are interesting because you might think that there are some interlocking or groups here who would have, different interest basically, and they would be at war with each other. But then some of these characters come along that kind of, they bridge these groups and they begin to work towards a common goal, shall we say.
Yeah, I wouldn't say he's exactly the guy you're talking about, but he was involved there as well. And it's just like you say, it was at this time, during these years, that they started working together. And he was one of the guys who helped to build the network. He later ended up in a barrel, chopped up with a chainsaw, when he started talking too much.
That's right. I actually, sorry, just a quick intro. I think Meyer Lansky would fit that profile a bit better, actually, as an interface between those two groups. But go ahead, Ole.
Yeah, but like I said, Johnny Rosselli was the go-between man, and he knew Meyer Lansky, he knew Carlos Marcello, and these, so he was the guy with all the contacts, with all also with the whole Hollywood, Frank Sinatra, the Rat
Yeah.
Pack, and also when it came to around Marilyn Monroe and so on. Some of the people who were part of the Kennedy assassination were also the ones that carried out the assassination of Marilyn Monroe. And anyway, so then there's another car coming in. I know there's a lot of researchers that don't agree with me about this one, but as far as I know, this is what happened. Santos Traficante, one of the other mob chief bosses, the whole idea was that everybody should supply shooters. Every single one that was involved should supply shooters as well, so that nobody could point a blaming finger at anyone else. Everybody should dip their hands in blood, just like when they killed Julius Caesar. And Lucien, no, Santos Traficante, he decided to go to use his connection in Marseille in France, and through them get some skilled killers flown in, because it's super good to use foreign people with no connections, no anything, which would be extremely hard to track back towards them. And one of the people that they flew in, They flew them from Marseille to Mexico City, and then from Mexico City they stayed there for a few weeks. Then they were driven up to Brownsville, and on the other side of the border they were picked up by a member of the Chicago mob who spoke Italian to them and drove them to Dallas, where they were staying in a safe house until the time came for the assassination. I would strongly suggest that this is the man that goes under the name of Batchman. Mm-hmm. Also Black, he's also been called Black Dog. His real name was Lucien Sarti, and he was an extremely skilled assassin, very, very daring, very, very careless, almost like he was feared by some people because he was so careless, he was so fearless that, but even though that made him dangerous to trust, it also made him one of the absolute best assassins because he just took care of business. Well, he didn't care about the risks. He got the job done.
Right.
I think that after the assassination, this team, there are some theories saying that the other two that was in this car from Marseille, the name was Savour Pronti and Roger Bocomoni. I'm not sure about the how you pronounce these names, but these three were the ones that were driven to Dallas, to this safe house.
The French names?
French names, French killers,
yep.
French everything.
Yep.
And after the assassination, they were flown out to Toronto. I think a possible pilot for that was a man by the name of Jules Rico Kimball, who was later also involved in the on the hit of Martin Luther King. And then from Toronto, they were flown to Marseille. They were later flown to Argentina, where they were paid in heroin. And this heroin was then changed by, I can't remember his name now, but changed into cash there. So, okay. So is this getting boring or is it too
No, it's very interesting because you're basically going through all these character, all these names, and these are all, I'm trying to take them all down as well as we go here so we can have some links here, you know, because no, this is really important stuff. And you, as you just kind of quickly graze over the bios of some of these people, you realize how, you know, deeply nested into the power structure they are. And at the same time, then it also gives people who are kind of listening to this an idea that, all right, if we have so many of these high profile people who probably at this point would at least have a lot of eyes on them, shall we say, because of their background and because of what they were involved in, if they are allowed to be in and around an area all at the same time where this kind of convergence is happening, it's quite obvious at this stage as well that you realize the complicity of the law enforcement, the government overall, that structure in part of this, because otherwise they would know that something is up. There's way too many of these people in one spot at the same time kind of, you know, coming in. So that shows this general idea as well that there we have a lot of different people in high places who are agreeing, shall we say, about what is to occur.
It's a lot more than agreeing. It's like they're organized together. Even they just know about their little part of the whole puzzle. And standard thing in these operations are that very often there are more than one operation going on at the same time, which will it's deliberately made like that so that if someone like myself come and start to try and figure out what the hell happened, it's going to point all over the place. So that is part of the whole structure, that there are different teams, different agendas going on at the same time.
Yeah.
But if you remember this green pickup truck that I told you about earlier, that was supposed to be parked on the parking lot behind the picket fence, that just an hour or 45 minutes before the assassination, there was a female witness by the name of Julianne Mercer who saw a green pickup that fits the description perfectly. It was parked just below the grassy knoll up on the pavement. And somebody was taking a rifle off the back of the pickup, just walking very slowly up towards the Texas School Book Depository. And so Julianne Mercer, she thought, oh my God, the Secret Service, they're not that secret, because she thought it was done so openly And she looked up the hill, you know, on the triple overpass. There were some police officers there standing talking and so on. So she thought there must be a secret service. But the man that was behind the wheel was somebody she identified the day after the assassination as Jack Ruby. Okay, so Jack Ruby was here driving this pickup that later turned up on the parking behind it. There's one very central person as well, at least one. His name, I mentioned him before, his name is James Files. Now, James Files was, he is the guy who claims to be the shooter from behind the picket fence. And like I say, I really, really tried to find things that he was lying about. But the only thing, the only lies that I've been able to point him down with are when he's lying about other people that were part of it that are still alive. Because he is, he's an, even though he's a very man of a lot of brutality and violence, he's also a man of great honor, a high codex of honor. Because this is the thing, it's very strange when you go into mob circles and so on, you think they're monsters, and they are if you look at what they're doing, but at the same time, they have a very, some of them have a very high sense of ethics and so on, and they would rather die than rat someone up and so on. Anyway, this James Files, he's not just anyone, because he was, he grew up in Chicago. His name was James Sutton during those years. And when he was 16, his sister got murdered. He took care of business by blowing the head off the guy who murdered her with a shotgun. And then he left the country and went into the military. Before he was even 18, he was part of the 82nd Airborne Division, the paratroopers, and he was very skilled. I mean, they saw right away that he had a lot of potential. So he was sent to Laos, and so he was one of these 16,000 so-called military advisors that was there. And what they did was that they were doing a lot of training of the local troops, but also seeing, not being aware of it, but they were also taking care of a lot of this thing with the drugs in and out and so on. And what happened at that time was that there was a situation where he had to show his loyalty to the Laotian army. And the way he did it was by executing two of his people, his own people. He did that with headshots. And from that day on, headshots has been his, like, his signature. He, after that, he was sent home to the States, and he was put in a military hospital. While he was there, he was approached by Ted Shackley from the CIA. Do you remember I mentioned him before?
Sure.
From Operation 40, Ted
Oh.
Shackley?
Oh, yeah.
And on the recommendation from Ted Shackley, James Files was approached by David Atlee Phillips. So David Atlee Phillips recruited him to the CIA, and from that day on, he was working both for the Chicago mob and the CIA. So when the CIA needed him, they just called him and so on. So David Atlee Phillips was his, what was called his controller. Now, what is really interesting is that David Atlee Phillips as well was the controller of Lee Harvey Oswald, the Patsy.
Mm-hmm.
And he was also the station chief of Mexico City at the time of the assassination. So he was very central in the whole black painting of Lee Harvey Oswald as a patsy, making him look absolutely super guilty. So this David Atlee Phillips, he's super central in this whole thing. Anyway, James Files was, like I say, he was recruited by the CIA, but at the same time, once he got back to Chicago, he was... Chucky Nicoletti, if you remember him, the hitman from Sam Giancana's hitman that came from the Grace Ranch and drove to Dallas, he was recruited by him as his driver because Chucky Nicoletti saw him in stock car races and stuff like that and saw that this guy is really good with weapons and cars. These are the two things that he's really good with. So he got him as his driver. He was only 19 at the time. And so the two of them were working all the time. You never saw one without the other. And so they did a lot of different killings in Chicago and so on. But this day, when it came to the hit in Dallas, James Files was only supposed to be there as a driver and a deliverer of the weapons and so on. So 5, 6 days before the assassination, he drove down alone from Chicago to Dallas, and he was driving in a 63 Chevy Impala. It was burgundy and with gun racks built in the seats, and there was about once all the gun racks were filled, it was about 40 weapons in the car, including hand grenades and so on. Incredible, with rotating, they called it a work car, rotating number plates and bulletproof sights, and the thing taking out of the old movies, that type of car.
Right. Yeah.
Very, very powerful engine as well. So he drove down to Dallas, and when he came to a place called Mesquite, just outside Dallas, and he stayed overnight at a place called the Lamplighter Motel. What he did then was that when he arrived, he made two phone calls, one to Chucky Nicoletti, just saying, "I'm here," and the other call was to David Atlee Phillips. Again, just saying, "I'm now in position, I'm here." Okay. What happened the very next morning was that no one less than Lee Harvey Oswald knocked on the door. And Lee Harvey Oswald had been asked by David Atlee Phillips to show him around, to show James Files around, learning about Dallas, learning about the roots, the streets. And he also took him out to a place on the outskirts of Dallas where he could test shoot his different weapons, calibrate the sights, check out the ammo, and so on. This is a bit intricate because Lee Harvey Oswald was a patsy. At the same time, he was involved in the whole assassination. But I truly believe that he was involved, he was duped into believing that he was part of stopping the killing of the president, that he was there to infiltrate the assassination team, but that his task was to stop it. And that when you see what happens before the assassination, there are some secret telegrams being sent to the FBI saying that there's a hit going down in Dallas. They're gonna go for JFK. The different interviews police take, they rip off all the notes, they flush them down, they burn them, they don't record anything. And this is the reason, because he knows so much and he cannot be allowed to talk. So anyway,
And don't leave any paper trail, obviously. You don't want anything of that to be found out. Yeah.
no paper trail, no paper trail. What James Files says that they spoke about anything, everything except the assassination. And this is standard procedure as well. When you speak to killers on this level, they, even though they know that somebody else is involved in it, or they know that there's not nothing, they never mention it. They just nod to each other sort of knowingly, but it's never mentioned. There's no question asked. There's no nothing, because if you start asking questions, you will not be living that long, in these surroundings. It's very dangerous to start sniffing around and being too nosy, and everybody is aware of that. So they just do their part and forget about the rest. But what James Files says, that the morning when Lee Harvey Oswald came to the Lamplighter Hotel, he was driving a blue Ford Falcon 57, I think. Somewhere between 57 and 61. There's a black Ford Falcon that is very central in the assassination. And just a suggestion, in these operations, sometimes a paint job is part of it. It's very easy to repaint a car before or after. And I would suggest this is a possibility, that it could be the same Ford Falcon that is observed later on. Because what happened was that in the parking lot behind the school book depository, or to the side of it, there was a watchtower where a man working for the railroad, his name was Lee Bowers, he was sitting there observing this area before the assassination. And one of the things was he saw three different vehicles driving around, coming into the parking area, driving around, cruising around like they were checking out stuff. And the first car he saw came in from Elm Street in front of the school book depository and then circled around, it cruised around like 3-4 minutes. So he was looking at it, and it was a black Ford Falcon, most probably from 1957. It had Texas plates, and he saw there was a man inside that talking in what he thought was a microphone. Like, then you go back to Chauncey Holt, who was the guy who supplied the fake Secret Service IDs and so on. He claims to have seen a man that he knew driving around in a Ford, black Ford Falcon in the parking lot speaking into a microphone. So I think we can say surely that this is the same man. He identified this man as Aldo Vera Serafin. Now, Aldo Vera Serafin at this time was one of the highest paid assassins globally. So here we are once again with a super, super star, if you want to call him that, in that area, in this small little place called Dealey Plaza. And when you look at it, like you speak to Dan Files or other people like that, they say it was like an old boys reunion.
Right.
Everywhere they looked, they recognized people. And in Dealey Plaza this day, there were people like Orlando Bosch, who is also called Dr. Death. He supplied bombs for hundreds of different terror acts over the years after the JFK assassination, all the way up to, I don't know, the latest around 2000, the year 2000. He was involved in the blowing up of Orlando Letier in Washington, D.C., as was James Files, and as was the Novo Sampol brothers that I mentioned before, coming from the car in Miami and so on. So it's the same people popping up again. There's another one, super terrorist, called Luis Posada Carrillas. He was there in Dealey Plaza, same, also member of Operation 40, and also part of, the amount of different assassinations and terror acts they've done, incredibly. And then pardoned by no one less than George Bush Sr., mm-hmm. believe it or not.
Yeah. Was that one of his, like, before he went out of office, one of his last things that they usually do? I think George Bush did the same thing. Bill Clinton did the same thing as well. They basically, the last couple of days, they pardoned some of these, you know, ardent criminals to get them out in the last day of presidency. Was there a similar scenario there, or was it just in the middle of it?
Yeah, I can't remember. But then this is typical as well. They also get the new president to pardon them before they stepped down.
Right. Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
I mean, Richard Nixon, he even had to change his vice president. He got rid of his vice president and got Gerald Ford in. Gerald Ford, that was also part of the Warren Commission afterwards, so that Gerald Ford could pardon him. You know, it's like, cover your trails.
Well, Ulla, let's just push the pause button basically here and just take a short break before we carry on in the next segment. I want to just carry on the story here, and we were just kind of getting into it really. But why don't we talk just a little bit about your website and tell us about the book that you've written as well, so people know where to go to find out more about you and follow you. And of course, I urge everyone who hasn't already to check out the series we did earlier, you know, last year, four programs basically in a row on the assassination of Olof Palme, the Swedish prime minister, and the connecting branches out there as well. But give us your web. I believe you have a new website address as well this time, right?
I have indeed. It's called lightonconspiracies.com. Lightonconspiracies.com. And the book you're talking about, I've got several books, but the book you're mentioning is called Coup d'etat in Slow Motion. And it's about the assassination of the Swedish prime minister, but also showing all the different links that is just spreading out globally that are connecting so many of these different events. And I've even managed to find people that were in Dealey Plaza when JFK was shot, that was in location in Stockholm some 23 years later Olof Palme was killed. So they're interlinked. It's totally incredible once you start getting into the magnitude of these things. And I just want to say as well to to do research like this for so many years, it's very, very hard without any funding. And when you've got a family to feed, it's extremely hard. So if anybody wants to help pull this load, I'm extremely grateful for donation. Extremely grateful. Also, I've got a newsletter that you can subscribe on that would also help finance my research and so on. So
Very good. Are you
they.
available for conferences, speaking engagements and such as well, Ola?
You name it, I'm right there. If I can, I'll be right there because I think it is extremely important to expose these things so that we can turn this world into this beautiful place it's meant to be. And I am one that will do my utmost all the way.
All right, very good. Lightonconspiracies.com. That's the new website to check out. We're going to have that linked up as well. Check out the book. And of course, if you want to help out Ola through donations, please go ahead and do so. All right, well, we'll take a short break right here. We'll be right back with more in just a little bit.
Thank you.